You're a geologist. You are known as the mercenary geologist, Mr.
True.
Fulp. What exactly got you into that career path? Where did it kind of all start for you?
Well, I loved rocks when I was a kid. I had a rock collection starting at age 7. Went to college as a petroleum engineer on a full ride to University of Tulsa. After 2.5 years, got all the math and science and physics and got into engineering. I decided did not want to run a calculator or a computer the rest of my career or sit on a rig in the North Sea, which were the job options back then. And so I wanted to work outside and became a geologist.
That's a very good reason. Was your transition into the mining industry very natural? Was it kind of always planned? It sounds like you kind of just, you liked rocks, you got into geology. What kind of got you into mining?
Well, I went to petroleum school, University of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. So I spent a summer working for an oil company, hanging well logs on the wall and looking at squiggly lines. And once again, I said, I want to work outside. How do I do that? And the mining industry became the ticket to that. So I went to University of New Mexico, got a master's degree, did a thesis on a copper project in the Pecos Belt above Santa Fe, sold the mining claims to a mining company. The mining company hired me, and I got to drill my thesis project, which really was designed to develop drill targets. Of course, it failed, but it launched a 30-plus year career as an exploration or economic geologist.
Okay, and so now, as of now, you evaluate projects, companies, and business development within the junior resource sector.
Correct.
Is that correct? Well, starting with the evaluation of mining projects, I mean, what exactly does this mean and how do you go about doing it?
Well, from the get-go, as an economic geologist, I would emphasize the word economic. I was very focused on evaluation of projects, will this work, will this not, and got very early on into the financial and the business development end of geology. Because I think I had my first brokerage account when I was 7 years old, 8 years old or something. My dad had a brokerage account in my name, and he liked to play the stock market, so I was always savvy in that. So when I became a mining analyst in 2007, it was very easy to really do as a profession now what I had done for other people and other companies for a considerable amount of time, which is evaluate mining projects. So I go to the field, I look, I say, you know, does this deposit have a chance to become a mine? Does this company have the proper share structure, people, and the projects to become successful and make money for its shareholders? If that's the case, then I will buy into the stock, and if it's one of the select few, for instance, right now, I own about 35 junior stocks. At any one time, I may have five on my coverage list, 5, maximum 10. So it's a very select group of companies when you consider there's, in at least the good times, about 1,500 resource companies on the Toronto Venture Exchange.
Yep, it's always a battle separating the good from the bad.
True.
And also, according to your bio, and this is from goldgeologist.com where I got this, your criteria to analyze a mining company are very strict. You reject more than 20 companies for everyone you agree to investigate further. You've also mentioned this variety of criteria which need to be met by these companies. And these have included, and I'm reading them out here, the company must have a tightly held and efficient share structure, must be led by trustworthy, experienced, and talented technical management teams. It must have a flagship property and favorable geological terrain. You also mentioned that the project must be in a geopolitically stable and environmentally friendly area that is permissive to develop a profitable mine. And you also mentioned that a cornerstone of your investment criteria is to choose companies that have a strong chance of doubling their share price in 12 months or less. In your experience, what kinds of companies have been able to do this, and how have they done this?
Well, if you look at a chart of any company on the Toronto Venture Exchange, I will challenge you to find a company that in any running 52-week period does not have a double from its high to it, or from its low to its high. They all do. They are all volatile stocks. So the idea is we want to go in when, as contrarians, when companies are unknown, unloved, or undervalued, and we want to buy them low. And if we buy them at the right time, within a year they'll double. The key to it is buying them at the right time. Right. So it doesn't matter.
Timing is everything.
It doesn't matter what commodity is. It actually doesn't matter. You could do this with every company on the Toronto Venture Exchange, but the timing is critical. It's much easier to get the timing right when a company has a good story that's likely to be successful.
I mean, and you say, too, that it doesn't matter which commodity because it's the methods that you use to investigate them apply to all of them. It's
well,
the same thing.
That's true, but that said, I'm very specific about the commodities that I think are favorable. So,
right.
You know, gold, copper, at times uranium, oil and gas. Mm-hmm. You know, I own Tungsten Company. We got into the rare earth business very early on, made a fortune in the rare earth business, absolute fortune. Stocks that started as penny stocks went to valuations of $6 or $9 or even $17. Today, would I put money in any rare earth company? Absolutely not. That was a bubble that we were lucky to get in early on. So once again, it's the timing of your speculations.
Well, very good. And you mentioned that the company must be led by a trustworthy, experienced, and talented technical management team. And what would be an example of a technical management team in a mining company, and how would you go about determining whether or not they're trustworthy, experienced, and talented? I mean, how do you evaluate the staff in a mining company unless you know them personally?
Well, I have an advantage because I know most of these people personally, or I get to know them personally because of my position as a newsletter writer and analyst. Opens doors, if you will. But that said, you want to look, in basic due diligence, which I do on a corporate presentation on a website, and that's the first thing I look at. Look at who they are, their track records, the companies they've been involved with before. I prefer to see in a junior company that's not a miner, I want to see a geologist or an engineer at the helm. I want that person to have a strong geological and engineering staff. I want the board of directors to include technical people and not be a bunch of accountants and financiers and lawyers, which is sometimes the case. So you look for that technical team, and you got to make sure that they've done it before and been successful. They haven't run three or four companies in the ground. If these are all venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. If you've bankrupted three companies in a row, you're no longer a venture capitalist or entrepreneur, in my opinion. You're just mining the stock market. So, and a lot of people do that. You want to look at salaries. There's a lot of criteria that need to be looked at. I actually offer a template to my subscribers that gives, it's a 4 or 5 page thing of everything I do before I take on a company. And so runs the gamut.
All right, very good. And on another item that was on your list of criteria for evaluating a mining company was that it must have in its possession a flagship property on favorable geological terrain. And what makes a flagship property a flagship property, in your opinion? What would be an example?
Yeah, so um, a, a flagship property is something that can develop, has the potential development in mind. So the real sweet spot for me in the business are the advanced explorers. So companies that have drill holes in a project have a resource, perhaps an initial qualified resource, and they offer the best upside with the less amount of risk. You know, venture capital always flows to where risk is perceived as lowest for the greatest potential reward. So that's, so it becomes a risk reward sort of valuation. Advanced Explorers, flagship property. When I wrote this, and this is the blurb on the website, that dates from about 8 years ago. But there's another model that we like in this business, and that's a prospect generator model, where they have a bunch of prospects which they vend out, joint venture, or sell to other companies to spend money on. So that prospect generator model without a flagship project also works.
Okay, very good. And in your musings too, just sort of, this is a slight change of topic, but in your musings, you are a strong uranium bull, and you have been for a while. For those of us who may not have read through all of your published information, what makes uranium worth looking into for investment? We're starting to move into the points of the interview just about uranium, but what makes uranium a worthwhile investment for those of us who haven't read all of your subscriptions?
Well, so let me start by, and I mentioned this previously, I'm a contrarian, so I like to buy into things that are unloved, unknown, or unwanted, or undervalued in the market at any particular time. So what we see with uranium is that short-term supply-demand fundamentals are not good. There is basically an oversupply of uranium in the world right now, but that will be worked off sometime in the period of 2017 to 2020. And there are 66 new reactors being built right now and 168 that are planned, which means they've either got financing or there's a footing built, you know, so permits are in place. So you do the math, and there just is not going to be enough uranium here in a few years. So this is a longer-term, mid-to-long-term speculation in the uranium business with companies that are extremely beaten down right now. So the thing about contrarianism is you have to have patience. So you take a position and you say, okay, I'm committed to this position. If the stock goes way down, I may buy some more and average down into it, but I am committed to this idea for the future. You got to make sure you pick companies that have staying power, and that can be a little tricky sometimes, but it's a longer-term contrarian play, uranium, for me.
So would you say that uranium is more predictable of a commodity than other commodities out there? Either because due to the fact that the majority of its demands rests entirely on nuclear power, almost. I mean, would that make it a more predictable commodity to forecast in its price?
I'm not sure if it does or not. You know, you've taken the speculation, the futures and options, the derivative markets out of it. But by the same token, uranium is a very opaque business. It's totally done either spot sales or across the table negotiations. So it is not a very transparent market. It's much more transparent than it used to be. For instance, now I get a daily spot uranium price. In the past, that came out once a week. So it's becoming more transparent, but I probably would not say it's any more predictable than any commodities are, but if you look at longer-term supply-demand fundamentals, it looks good. So does copper by that same token.
It's one to definitely keep an eye on. And you recently released a report, speaking of which, titled The Path to Enrichment. And this was on the next big boom in uranium and how to profit from it. And in your report, you mentioned how Cold War weapons stockpiles continue to play a critical role on the supply side of the equation for uranium. So exactly how much do the decommissioning of these weapons for their uranium impact the overall market?
Well, that was a big white paper of about 8,000 words, and I wrote half of it, and Brian Lennon, my co-author, wrote half of it. I did not write the Cold War weapon part, and I'm not sure I would agree with that, that take that there are a lot of nuclear weapons still remaining. There are half-hearted efforts to reduce nuclear arsenals and do what was done for 23 years from 1990 to 2013, which was take Russian nuclear bombs and convert those from high-enriched uranium to low-enriched uranium. That program ended in 2013. There has been no weapons-grade replacement for that program, and I don't know if it's going to happen or not. More concerning to me overhanging the uranium market would be U.S. government stockpiles. The DOE, especially under the Obama administration, seems to dump a bunch of uranium on the market at inopportune times every year. You know, price a year ago hit over $40, and here comes the DOE and sold 3 million pounds of uranium hexafluoride into the market, which killed the market, so the spot market. So there's lots of external factors in the uranium space, but those are mainly more near-term factors, so I prefer to look out until and see in a 3 to 5 year period, 1 to 4 year period, I'm not really sure, when we will have a dearth of uranium supplies for all the new reactors coming online.
All right, that is fantastic. And we are just about out of time for today, Mr. Fulp, but thank you very much for joining us this evening, and have a safe trip back to where you came from. Thank you again very much.
All right, thanks a lot, Daniel.